And now we begin the reading of today's Boston Globe for this Tuesday, the 9th of June, 2026, here on the Talking Information Center, and we say hello to Liza and Peter.
Good morning, everyone. This is Liza speaking. I am going to read an article from the front page of today's Globe. Platinum may win, but primary still a test. Maine's Democratic Senate contest could reflect resilience of his support. The populist insurgent Graham Platner, Maine's Senate primary election, had been shaping up as a coronation. All of a sudden, it's looking more like a test. When Maine Democrats' ballots are counted on Tuesday, Platner remains all but certain to become their nominee to take on Republican Senator Susan Collins, given that his top rival, Governor Janet Mills, suspended her campaign in April. But after the events of the last 2 weeks, during which Platner faced fresh damaging allegations about his past conduct, the primary contest is now serving as a potentially revealing data point for how effectively he is weathering the scrutiny and consolidating support. Mills remains on the primary ballot, a fact she has reminded Democratic voters of in recent days, as does a third candidate, David Costello, who has been actively campaigning but has not picked up remotely as much traction as Platner. Some Maine Democrats have said they still intend to vote for Mills, even though her campaign has been inactive. The question now is how many primary voters actually cast a ballot for someone other than Platner. The answer may well shape the early contours of a Senate race with massive implications for the balance of power in Washington and the direction of both parties. On Monday, as they gathered at election eve events for Maine's Democratic gubernatorial hopefuls, Platner supporters expressed confidence that the ground had not totally shifted underneath his campaign in the final stretch of the primary. Sarah Nichols, the former mayor of Bangor, told the Globe she believed only a small number of Democrats would cast a protest vote for Mills, who were not supporting her campaign to begin with. I haven't seen anywhere he's losing people in the way I thought might happen, she said, as she attended an election eve cookout for governor candidate Troy Jackson, a close ally of Platner, overlooking the Penobscot River. If Platner notches 75% to 80% support in Tuesday's primary, I'd feel really confident, Nichols said. Later that evening, Secretary of State Sheena Bellows rallied with supporters in Ellsworth, where many locals know Platner and his family. His mother runs a popular restaurant nearby. Among that crowd, there was anger and frustration over the increasing national frenzy of coverage and attention on Platner, as well as a sense that it was not capturing the realities of his support on the ground. The national discourse is bonkers, said Shayna Nickerson, a teacher from nearby Hancock, who was supporting Platner. We know who he is and who he's not. Her husband, Michael, also a teacher, believes there's been a backlash that has mobilized even more support for Platner. People are like the outrage feels artificial, he said. Meanwhile, national Republicans are increasingly bullish that Platner's baggage means that Collins can defy midterm headwinds and pull out a victory, preserving GOP hopes for keeping the Senate majority. Democrats see Maine as a must-win state, given Collins is the only GOP senator up for re-election this year in a state President Trump lost in 2024. But the past 2 weeks have resurfaced some of the intra-party fissures of a Democratic primary race that had effectively been over since April. Once Mills dropped out, Platner was polling strong and working to consolidate support in the party. He waded into the competitive Maine governor primary, testing his growing political cred by backing three of the five Democratic contenders in the state's ranked choice system. Excuse me. Then on May 30th, the Wall Street Journal reported that in the campaign's early days, Platner's wife, Amy Gertner, notified a staffer that she had found explicit text on his phone shortly after they were married in late 2023. They had worked on their marriage and counseling, but the report landed differently than previous reports on his past inflammatory social media comments. Suddenly, Platinum was answering tough questions about recent conduct, a period where he supposedly settled down and healed instead of details from his military or post-military years. Then the New York Times reported last Thursday that several of Platner's ex-girlfriends alleged disturbing behavior, primarily Lindsay Fifield, a Virginia conservative activist who dated him over a decade ago. She told the paper that he once grabbed her, shoved her into her room, and refused to let her leave, among other incidents. Platner denied that he was ever physically violent with any romantic partner, while acknowledging he had in the past not been a good boyfriend. His campaign seemed to survive the latest onslaught of attention around the stories. On Friday, Representative Co Khanna, a California Democrat, kept his plans to rally with Platner in Bar Harbor. They were joined by Jackson and congressional candidate Matt Dunlap. But soon, every major Democrat who'd aligned with Platner was being asked about the reports, and not everyone pushed back against the stories. Gubernatorial candidate Hannah Pingree said Platner's accusers were very brave to speak up and said they deserved to be heard, while saying only Platner could make the case to Maine voters to still earn their support. Pingree is part of a ranked choice voting alliance with Jackson and Pingree that Platner has backed. After the initial journal report, Mills emerged, telling the Portland Press Herald that while she had suspended her campaign, she remained on the primary ballot. Some Democrats planned to vote for her. State Representative Cassie Julia, for instance, told The Globe last week that while she didn't have a beef with Platner, she would vote for Mills on Tuesday. "My plan is to vote for Janet Mills because she's on the ballot and our votes for her still count," Julia said. Last week, unnamed sources close to the governor told news outlets that Maine Democrats were privately reaching out to her to encourage her to get back into the race. But Mills did not, making the whole situation that much more unsettled. On Monday, Mills traveled to Boston for a memorial for former Representative Barney Frank. Asked by The Globe if she was thinking about how she might perform in Tuesday's election, Mills said, "I'm not going to comment on that," as she left the service. Mills entered the primary last year, months after Platner, and with the full backing of the Senate Democratic leadership in Washington, a move that felt like an unwanted intervention to some in Maine. When she exited the race amid lackluster fundraising and energy around the campaign, Mills did not endorse Platner or mention him at all in her statements about the news. But even if Mills did re-enter the race, it's likely too late. Maine voters have been permitted to mail in or drop off their ballots starting early May. Last week, the final week of early voting, state data showed that 35,000 people had already voted, with nearly three-quarters casting Democratic ballots. Maine's system of ranked choice voting is expected to make for a long week of tabulation to determine the winner of the contested Republican and Democratic gubernatorial primaries. But it's likely the picture of the Democratic Senate primary will be more clear by late Tuesday night. Platner's core supporters are already eager to move on to the next fight. "When negative stories come out about him, it hurts us all," said MJ Sheppers of Bar Harbor, who said she has known Platner's mother for 20 years, and it makes us give him more money. Well, let's hope the Democrats win.
I guess so. And good morning, everybody, from front page of today's Globe. Late-night public pints get approved. Massachusetts lawmakers on Monday embraced a proposal that would allow bars to serve alcohol until 3 a.m. and permit fans to imbibe in designated public spaces through the end of July. In a bid to capitalize on the slate of World Cup matches the state is hosting, the Massachusetts House and Senate voted to send Governor Maura Healey the bill Monday afternoon, and she signed it 5 days before FIFA World Cup matches begin in Foxborough. The proposal's passage, put on the relative fast track through Beacon Hill just last week, was briefly gummed up in the legislative gears Monday after the State House and Senate initially disagreed on key details about letting booze flow more freely in the coming months. Healy has already said she supported allowing Massachusetts bars and restaurants to remain open until 3 a.m. this summer and loosening the state's drinking laws, at least temporarily. On Instagram on Monday, the governor reposted a story about whether she would sign the bill set to Post Malone's song, Pour Me a Drink.
Mm.
This bill will provide more opportunities for people to celebrate with their community for the World Cup and other exciting events we have happening this summer for Mass 250, Healy said in a statement after signing the bill. The push to allow for more pints, however, hasn't been universally embraced. Boston service workers have fretted that the extended hours could be challenging for employees who already work late nights and that larger crowds and more drinking, period, could lead to more confrontations inside bars. The Massachusetts Senate on Monday passed its own version of the proposal, which would have allowed public drinking in designated spots through Labor Day, which falls on September 7th, roughly 5 weeks beyond what the House wanted. The House ultimately got its way, setting both temporary changes to expire on July 31st and aligning with the version the chamber passed on Thursday. A proposal to push back last call gained a drumbeat of support in recent weeks among elected leaders, including Boston Mayor Michelle Wu and State Senate President Karen Spilka, who agreed it would help local businesses capitalize on an expected surge of visitors for the World Cup matches at Gillette Stadium in Foxborough. The state is hosting 7 matches in total at what's been rebranded as Boston Stadium, including Sunday's clash between Haiti and Scotland. I'm sorry, that was Saturday's clash between Haiti and Scotland. The World Cup is coming to town, and for once we're not turning in early, State Senator Barry Feingold said. Mm-hmm. Come on, tell us what you really think, Liz.
Sorry about that.
It's not just soccer that's driving it, officials say. Legislative leaders on Monday also pointed to celebrations around America's 250th anniversary and the arrival of tall ships from around the world to Boston Harbor as major tourist events expected to draw people to the region. Summer 2026 represents a unique opportunity for Massachusetts, said State Representative Carol Fiola, who sponsored the original bill. Senator Julian Sir, a Provincetown Democrat who put forward the Senate's initial proposal, said creating public drinking areas is a heavy lift for a city or town and argued that extending the period of time they can make use of those spaces would incentivize more leaders to opt in. While a later last call at bars seems geared towards the World Cup, he said public consumption is an activity that would extend conviviality and advance opportunity for local businesses. And other things too, huh, Liza?
Yes.
Yes. If towns are going through the trouble of doing this, why not enable them to have this opportunity to the full extent of the summer, he said, of the Senate's bid to extend the loosened rules into early September. We don't want this to be just for the World Cup. State Representative Alan Mishlowitz, a North End Democrat and his chamber's budget chief, felt the opposite. When we were pitching the concept, it was almost always centered around the events we were having this summer, he said, adding that the last World Cup match in Boston ends July 9th. We would certainly keep an open mind on it in the long term and for future big events in the city. For now, it's a test case. Other states have embraced similar changes. In Rhode Island, whose border is less than 30 miles from the stadium, Governor Daniel J. McKee signed a similar bill into law last month. Kansas, Missouri, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Washington, states either hosting World Cup matches or geographically adjacent to those hosting the tournament, have also approved measures to extend alcohol sale hours. Leaders at the Massachusetts Restaurant Association, which represents about 1,800 restaurants, said the short trial period for the later last call allows bar operators to try something new. Not all of those in the industry back the idea, though. Joseph Milano, owner of the 200-year-old Union Oyster House, said he is personally not in favor of staying open late or drinking in public, citing the liabilities a restaurant assumes when people stay out late drinking. Support for a later last call marks a notable shift among Beacon Hill legislators who have long resisted boozy measures. A repeated proposal to end a 40-year ban on happy hours has faced an uphill battle through the State House. Sear has argued that the state has a persistent fun problem, and while he's successfully gotten a measure through his own chamber that could allow restaurants to offer drink specials for the first time since 1984, it's never passed the House. Spilka framed the last call bill as an opportunity to revisit broader changes in the future. This pilot is a chance for us to see firsthand how thoughtful, targeted flexibility in our liquor laws can benefit our economy and our communities, the Ashland Democrat said in a statement. If this summer shows what we believe it will, I hope it opens the door to a broader conversation about modernizing these laws for the long term. What do you think, Liza?
I don't know, Pete.
I don't know.
Keep our fingers crossed, right?
Yeah, we'll see.
Okay, this next article is from the Nation section of today's Globe. New Yorkers waited a century for subway expansion. After false starts, line to Harlem gets green light. New Yorkers are accustomed to waiting for the train, but Harlem residents have waited a century for the queue. Plans to extend the subway line to 125th Street in Manhattan were first dashed in 1929 by the Great Depression. Then in the 70s, New York City's fiscal crisis halted tunnel work. In the 2000s, construction began on an extension as far as 96th Street, but dragged on and on. Now, after the latest setback, a months-long funding fight with the Trump administration, the Northwood expansion is finally moving forward. On Monday, Governor Kathy Hochul, wielding a golden shovel, broke ground on the latest stage of the project, a nearly $7 billion extension of the Q line to East 125th Street and Lexington Ave. We're not going to let the president or his administration stand in our way, she said, vowing to finish the project. The three new stations at 106, 116, and 125th Streets are expected to be completed by in 2032, adding new service for about 100,000 daily riders and a connection to the numbers 4, 5, and 6 trains and the Metro North Railroad. On Thursday, Hochul toured part of the incomplete train tunnel beneath East 116th Street and 2nd Avenue and was startled in the 1970s, but abandoned years later when the city nearly went bankrupt. This has been talked about for longer than people's lifetimes, Hochul said, standing on a damp and cracked concrete platform. This is going to be absolutely transformational. In recent months, the fate of the project was once again in limbo. The Metropolitan Transportation Authority, the state agency that runs the subway, sued the federal government in March for withholding close to $60 million in promised funding for the expansion. New York is ultimately counting on roughly half of the project's funding, $3.4 billion, to come from Washington. But the federal government suspended payments in October in an apparent attempt to pressure Democrats during a government shutdown. The U.S. Department of Transportation said the funding had been paused because of a review of the MTA's diversity and inclusion policies. In April, citing changes to those rules, the federal government agreed to release the money. On Thursday, Hochul said, "We're ready to build, and the money's now in place." Representative Adriano Espalante, whose district includes Harlem, and who has pushed for the subway extension for years, said in an interview that the project would not only bring better transit to an underserved area, but would also create 16,000 jobs. This is not just about three subway stops. This is about being the economic engine for Harlem, he said. During the tunneling in the 1970s, Harlem residents suffered through years of disruption, noise, and pollution with nothing to show for it, said Dan McNichol, the author of Second Avenue Subway, building New York City's most famous thing that never built. It was a heartbreak, he said, and a waste of resources. He marveled that after decades, the New York City has the chutzpah to persevere, and proceed with the project. But many challenges remain. The MTA is in the complicated process of connecting the long-abandoned tunnel beneath 116th Street with new construction, while digging through some of the most finicky soil conditions in the city. Streets between East 105th and East 110th Streets on 2nd Avenue will be cut open to connect the most recent expansion of the Q Line with the remnants of the 1970s tunnel further north and beyond. Matthew Zetmark, a project executive for the construction, called that integration the linchpin of the entire expansion. Two hulking custom-made tunnel boring machines will arrive in Harlem next year to drill a 20-foot-wide underground path to 125th Street. But parts of Upper Manhattan are on a high water table, so digging will require redirecting gushing groundwater. Whoops. Nickel describes some of the soil conditions as quicksand-like. To stabilize the site for evacuation, a towering drilling rig near East 120th Street on Thursday was pumping a cement mix deep into the dirt to harden the soil and prevent flooding during the tunneling. A boring machine is expected to be lowered into the existing tunnel and begin drilling in March. Jana Lieber, the MTA's current chief exec, who did not oversee that phase of construction, said the agency was on track to deliver this project on budget and on time, thanks to design and logistical changes. Yay for New York City.
Good going, New York City.
After 100 years. Mm. Over to you, Pete.
Okay. And from the nation section of today's Globe, studies suggest a link between phones and the birth rate. The enduring mystery of the fertility decline has a new culprit, the smartphone.
Mm.
Hmm. Experts have long wondered if phones play a role in the birth rate decline, which began in 2007, the same year that Apple introduced the iPhone. But until now, there has not been much evidence to prove it. Two papers, one published Monday and the other in May, are the first academic endeavors that test whether the smartphone was a cause.
Oh, boy.
They are the most recent efforts to explain the sweeping fertility rate decline in the United States and other countries over the past 20 years. Researchers have already looked at contraception use, abortion rates, rising levels of female education, and even the popular television show 16 and Pregnant, which parenthetically I have never even heard of, so I don't even know what that is. Proving phones caused a decline is a tricky endeavor. There were several major events in those years, including the Great Recession, and isolating smartphone use is difficult. The gold standard for scientific evidence is known as random assignment. It compares outcomes for people randomly chosen to receive a treatment, like getting a smartphone, with people who are not. I wonder where they're going to find somebody who does not have a smartphone.
Mm-hmm. Good question.
But that is not possible when it comes to ferreting out reasons for declining fertility. So researchers sought out data about smartphones that introduced randomness. Caitlin Myers, an economist at Middlebury College, and Ezekiel Hooper, her student, used the spotty early rollout of the iPhone as a way to isolate the effects of the phone on fertility. The first iPhone was released in June of 2007, they wrote, and was available only on the AT&T network until February 2011. The study compared fertility rates in U.S. countries that had near universal AT&T coverage with countries that had little or none. Their paper, published in the National Bureau of Economic Research, found that the iPhone caused as much as half of the fertility decline between 2007 and 2011. The most pronounced effects were among young people aged 15 to 24. What happened in the countries with iPhones? One theory, Myers said, is that young people began to socialize more on their phones and less in person, and consequently were less likely to have sex and become pregnant.
Oh.
Myers said iPhones may also have made pornography more accessible, which led young people to substitute it for sex, or young people may have used them to obtain better information on avoiding pregnancy. Dropping birth rates, once a feature of rich societies, are now a near global phenomenon. The authors of the second study also decided to look at smartphones. Countries with very different healthcare systems, welfare regimes, abortion laws, religious traditions, recessions, and democratic and demographic trends all saw similar breaks in the same window, wrote the authors Hernine Moscoso Boedo, an economics professor at the University of Cincinnati, and Nathan Hudson, a doctoral student. Whatever caused it was something global, something that arrived in roughly the same form in all those places at roughly the same time, they wrote. They analyzed World Bank data measuring smartphone penetrations and teenage fertility rates in 128 countries. In countries as varied as Iran, Costa Rica, Guatemala, Chile, Mexico, and Turkey, they found that teenage fertility declines accelerated once smartphones became a mass phenomenon. They tested their technology theory in the United States using data on wired broadband and 4G high-speed mobile networks. They looked at whether access was better and worse and found a substantial effect that fertility rates for teenagers declined fastest in countries with more high-speed access. Theodore Joyce, an economist at Baruch College, said he was skeptical of both studies.
Me too.
Teenage births have been falling since the 1990s, he said, long before technology came on the scene. Myers' paper, he said, examined a short period before smartphones had fully penetrated. And that's that article. Over to you, Liza.
Well, thank you very much, Pete. This next article is also from the Nation section of today's Globe. Mass judge throws out Trump's $100,000 fee for H-1B visas. A Trump administration initiative to impose a $100,000 fee on employees seeking visas for skilled foreign workers amounts to an unlawful tax on those companies that must be voided in its entirety, a federal judge ruled Monday. The decision by U.S. Judge Leo Sorokin in Massachusetts nullified one of a series of tactics the administration has used to restrict legal immigration, even in fields in which foreign skilled labor helped address severe shortages. In a 52-page opinion, Sorokin acknowledged that the policy imposed in September appeared to step on Congress' excessive power to levy taxes under the Constitution. He dismissed claims by the Trump administration that the fee was a regulatory payment that would have been within the executive branch's power to set, not a tax. This is a mere ipsy-dixit, he wrote, meaning offered without evidence. Defendants offer no definition for what constitutes a regulatory payment, cite no cases or statutes employing the term, and advance no reasoned argument explaining how this term encompasses something different than a tax or a penalty. Sorokin wrote that the rule was hastily formulated with no formal process or request for public comment. Despite what might have been broad opposition to the rule across many industries that have historically relied on the visa program to fill critical needs. The Trump administration argued in filings that the H-1B program has been deliberately exploited to replace rather than supplement American workers with lower paid, lower skilled labor. President Trump said the $100,000 fee would incentivize companies to hire more U.S. citizens into higher-paying roles. About 85,000 new visas have been provided annually to hire so-called high-skilled foreign workers at companies through the program's lottery process. Technology, finance, hospitals, and universities have all made ample use of those visas. A variety of companies have said the fee would be prohibitively expensive, in particular for smaller companies and nonprofit groups that rely on hiring workers from abroad. A coalition of 20 states sued to end the policy in December, arguing it was certain to exacerbate shortages of skilled workers, including teachers, academic researchers, and medical workers. The ruling came nearly 6 months after Judge Beryl Howell, an appointee of Barack Obama, reached the opposite conclusion in a different case, allowing the administration to move forward with the visa fee. She said the administration had the right to impose the fee because under federal immigration law, Congress had given the president broad authority to regulate entry into the United States for immigrants and non-immigrants alike. But Sorokin, also an Obama appointee, wrote that the Supreme Court has maintained throughout several cases, including one against Trump's tariffs and another regarding penalties under the Affordable Care Act, that the president can only impose a tax or penalty when explicitly authorized by Congress. The visa change was one of several that appeared designed to take advantage of pressure points to restrict immigration flows and compel foreigners living in the country legally to leave. It fell hardest on highly educated professionals who had seen the program as a comparatively secure route to life in America. Federal judges have repeatedly found that Trump's efforts to restrict various immigration programs were at odds with federal immigration law as Congress wrote it. Okay, that's a good one. Over to you, Pete.
Thank you. And from the world section of today's Globe, Cuba's cars idle as U.S. energy blockade deepens the fuel crisis. A worsening fuel crisis across Cuba is testing the island's famed almond drones, the vintage American cars that serve as vital shared taxis and embody the island's ingenuity and endurance. These days, many of these iconic gas-guzzling antique cars sit idle. Casualties of the fuel shortages that have gripped Cuba since January and that Cuban officials blame on a U.S. energy blockade. Outside his modest concrete block home on a dirt road in Las Minas, a town of about 2,000 people on the outskirts of Havana, Dariel Valdez is restoring a 1951 Chevrolet Deluxe. The burgundy body is intact and the original engine still works. Finding fuel for it, however, is another matter. Valdez is among thousands of Cubans waiting for fuel through a government reservation app that for many has become a symbol of the shortages it was designed to manage. I signed up in February. I'm still somewhere around number 2800, said the 27-year-old who runs an auto body shop from his home. The rewards for the wait will be 20 liters, or about 5.3 gallons, of gasoline. Enough fuel, Valdez says, to get him to the beach. The name Almendron comes from the Spanish word for almond, a reference to the round shape of the large American sedans imported before Cuba's 1959 revolution. For decades, sanctions, shortages, and limited imports forced Cuban mechanics to become masters of improvisation. Engines were swapped, bodies rebuilt, and replacement parts sourced from wherever they could be found. On a recent night in Havana, as another blackout darkened much of the city, taxi driver Leonardo Daniel Gonzalez steered a friend's glowing purple 1948 Chevrolet Fleetmaster through the darkness. These cars are passed down from generation to generation, said Gonzalez, 30. Cuba is experiencing one of the most severe energy crises in years. The population, already battered by decades of economic crises and shortages, is now navigating daily blackouts that can last up to 20 hours in some parts of the island. The country produces only about 40% of the fuel it consumes and depends heavily on imports to keep its power plants running and its transportation network moving. Since January, the Trump administration has tightened sanctions on Cuba as an element of its ongoing pressure campaign against the island's communist government. Trump also threatened tariffs on countries that sell or transport oil to Cuba, further complicating the island's efforts to secure fuel supplies. Just a single Russian tanker has delivered oil to the island nation since then. Standing beside his Chevrolet in Las Minas, Valdez, who owns the auto body shop, said the fuel shortage is also affecting his livelihood. He learned auto body work from his stepfather and has been repairing classic cars since he was 13. People don't want to do major repairs anymore, he said. A lot of them have their cars parked. They don't have much hope that they'll be circulating the way they used to. As gasoline becomes harder to obtain, many drivers are turning to Cuba's black market, where fuel can often be found more quickly, though at significant higher prices that can reach up to $8 per liter or $30 per gallon. Back in Havana, Gonzalez is not ready to write off the almond drones. Despite the lack of fuel and a sharp decline in tourism, he can still make a living off the old Chevrolet.
Well, good for him.
Yeah, I thought my first car was old, and it was a 63 Chevy.
Yeah, that was pretty old. I know. Okay, this next article is from the opinion page of today's Globe. Massachusetts built biotech. China is catching up. The state can't afford to lose the state's signature industry. Massachusetts helped invent the modern biotechnology industry when Cambridge passed the first municipal law regulating recombinant DNA, or gene splicing, in 1977. Since then, decades of state support and private risk-taking have made the state the world leader in biotechnology, home to more than 1,000 life science companies. That leadership is now under serious threat. In 2024, Massachusetts lost 1,101 biopharma research and development jobs, the first decline ever reported by the Massachusetts Biotechnology Council. Nearly one-third of Greater Boston lab space, 13.3 million square feet, currently sits empty and is available for rent. The decline in the region's biotechnology industry is not an accident. China has been targeting biotechnology as a strategic priority since 2015, specifically planning to emulate Boston's ecosystem. That approach is now bearing fruit at our expense. According to the House Select Committee on China, there was about $136 billion in cross-border out-licensing transactions between American and multinational pharmaceutical companies and Chinese biotech firms in 2025. The company also found that nearly half of large global pharmaceutical licensing deals of $50 million or more were signed with Chinese companies last year, up from 0% in 2020. It's no surprise that China wants to lead biotechnology. It's a sector that saves lives, fuels economies, and defines national security. But Americans would be foolish to continue outsourcing their best ideas, hollowing out a strategic industry, and causing homegrown labs to sit underused and local scientists to lose their jobs. Last week, Representatives John Molinar and Debbie Dingell of Michigan introduced the Biotech Investment National Security Act, a bipartisan bill that would add biotechnology to the Comprehensive Outbound Investment National Security Act, known as the COINS Act. The COINS Act is built around a simple idea. American capital and expertise should not be used to build the strategic technologies of foreign adversaries. Semiconductors, artificial intelligence, and quantum computing are already on the list. Biotechnology should be the next. Biotechnology is one of the defining frontiers of the 21st century, shaping the future of medicine, food, manufacturing, climate resistance, pandemic response, and national defense. Treating it as less important than chips or AI would be a failure of imagination. A targeted outbound investment screen isn't a retreat from competition. China has used state-directed industrial policy to build its strategic sectors for years, and the COINS Act is simply a reciprocal defensive measure. It holds that American capital, technical assistance, and deal structures should not strengthen adversary-controlled strategic capabilities. That's right. Pharmaceuticals also give the United States unusual leverage. The USC Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics found that the United States accounts for roughly 74 to 78% of worldwide pharmaceutical profits. That profit pool comes from American patents, employers, insurers, and taxpayers. They have every right to ask whether their money is financing the future of biotechnology in U.S. innovation centers like Massachusetts and California, or whether it is building strategic dependence on China. There is a concern that Chinese biotech assets could attempt to sidestep these measures by routing their investments through licensing deals, foreign intermediaries, or royalty streams. Policymakers will need to address beneficial ownership, control, data access, and ultimate use. But evasion risk is an argument for writing the rules more carefully, not for inaction. Ultimately, success will depend on pairing COINS with an affirmative agenda to keep the United States, and Massachusetts in particular, the best place in the world to discover, test, manufacture, and scale new medicines and biotechnologies. That means continuing to fund basic research at universities and hospitals, which generates billions of dollars of economic activity each year. It means embracing new technologies like the autonomous labs and AI to make research dramatically more productive, so U.S. scientists can compete with lower-cost scientific lab labor in China. And it means supporting clinical trial infrastructure and helping founders use the lab capacity we already built. Massachusetts has extraordinary talent, world-class hospitals, universities producing breakthrough science, and a pool of founders that can fill its empty labs. Massachusetts politicians and biotechnology industry leaders should back BINSA so U.S. capital is no longer driving the offshoring of our strategic biotechnology capacity. Boston built this industry. China has studied that model and is trying to replicate it. We should take the compliment seriously and compete.
Whew. Whoa.
Okay. Yeah. Over to you, Pete.
Thank you. Now I'm energized.
Good.
Okay. So from the opinion section of today's Globe, the limits of Mayor Wu's hardball politics. So much for the theory that women govern differently than men by choosing collaboration and compromise over confrontation and score settling. That's not the case with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. Her hardball politics, including a penchant for vendettas, is often compared to that of the late Mayor Tom Menino, for whom she interned it as a Harvard Law student. On the retribution front, her relish for revenge, as contrarian Boston calls it, also brings to mind President Trump. Last week, Wu endorsed Latoya Gale, a political newcomer and community advocate, over State Senator Nick Collins of South Boston, seemingly because Collins blocked Wu's effort to win state approval for a plan to shift more of the city's property tax burden onto commercial real estate. To make sure Collins got the message, Wu said, "We're tired of our senators blocking solutions that came out of a vote of the City Council and the House of Representatives, town halls, meetings, organizing unions, state leaders, everyone coming together to say, we need relief and we need help now. I have no problem when someone challenges an incumbent. Contested elections are signs of a healthy democracy. Wu-backed candidates also have a record of winning, so her endorsement could make a difference in this race."
But what does her anti-Collins crusade accomplish for Wu? If kicking Collins out of office is all she wants and what she gets, then revenge will be sweet, just like revenge was sweet for Trump when his endorsement of Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton led to the primary election defeat of Senator John Cornyn. But if winning support for some type of tax relief is still Wu's goal, how does this help her cause? Relations between Wu and the Senate President Karen Spilka already icing over the tax showdown. Targeting Collins doesn't seem like a good way to warm them up. Neither does the challenge to State Senator Will Brownsberger, who also opposed Wu's tax shift proposal, from Daniel Lander, a former Wu aide. While Wu is not yet officially weighing in on that contest, her fingerprints are on it. When she refiled her tax relief proposal in January 2025, Wu said it reflected compromise with business groups. The Senate rejected it last January, and there's still no sign of any changes of heart. Any push for tax relief now would come against the backdrop of the city's increasingly tough fiscal situation. A decrease in commercial property values has led to a decrease in commercial property tax revenue, which influences how much the city can spend. The decline in commercial property values forced an increase in residential property taxes, which is what Wu was trying to avoid with her tax proposal. What cards does she hold now? Maybe Collins and Brownsberger will feel vulnerable enough to switch their positions, leading Spilka to give Wu what she wants. But that kind of capitulation to Boston is not customary on Beacon Hill. While Wu's goals for government are completely different from Trump's, in a good way, her attitude towards those she governs raises another Trump parallel. Trump has made it clear he only seeks to represent people who vote for him and remain loyal to him. He has no interest in building bridges to political opponents. Of course, Wu isn't as extreme as Trump, but on several fronts, she has not shown much appetite for bridge building either. After the Emerald Necklace Conservancy waged a still unresolved legal battle against Wu's White Stadium renovation plan, the nonprofit was denied a permit to hold its annual Party in the Park fundraiser at Pine Bank Promontory in Jamaica Plain. Mm. Because of their disagreement over taxes, she boycotted the St. Patrick's Day parade breakfast that Collins hosted, and last year, over the same issue, she stayed away from the Boston Municipal Research Bureau's annual meeting. While those moves can be written off as petty and meaningless in the larger scheme of politics, taking on Collins and Brownsberger is serious business, with potentially serious consequences, not just for them, but also for the city's fortunes on Beacon Hill. After Wu crushed challenger Josh Kraft in the September preliminary election by 49 points, he dropped out of the race. The final election drew roughly 20% of registered voters. Since she was unopposed, there was little incentive to vote in November, and those who did represent a tiny slice of the city's electorate. It's far from a mandate. Meanwhile, she has to address many of the issues Kraft called her out on, from community opposition to bike lanes and the need for more aggressive approach to public safety to the drop in commercial real estate values and the budget crunch that has ensued. It was his job as a candidate to make this case, and he couldn't. But today, if Kraft had any desire to say, "I told you so," he would not be wrong. Kraft also called for a more collaborative, less confrontational style of governing. But that's not Wu's way. It works for her, but does it work for Boston? Good question.
Yep.
Okay. Over to you, Linda.
Thank you, Pete. This next article is from the business section of today's Globe. Massachusetts job growth skips key industries. With the exception of health care, the state's traditional economic engines are losing momentum as hiring lags for third straight year. This article is by Larry Edelman. The job market's back, at least parts of it. Hiring, which stalled last year as the economy slowed, has kicked back into gear, even in laggard Massachusetts. But hold the applause. With the exception of healthcare, the state's core knowledge industries are stuck in neutral for what is now a third straight year. The latest. U.S. employers added a surprisingly strong 172,000 jobs in May, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported Friday. That brought the average for the past 3 months to 188,000, compared with a measly monthly average of 10,000 throughout last year. Massachusetts is normally on the upswing. In the year through April, the latest month available, the state gained 10,600 jobs after shedding a combined 4,500 in 2024 and 25. Encouraging news? No doubt. Especially since there hasn't been much change in the conditions that slowed hiring here last year. Most notably, headwinds created by high interest rates, shifting U.S. trade policies, and the rapid acceleration in AI's capabilities. Yet the very sectors that have made the Massachusetts economy exceptional are still underperforming. Why it matters. The local economy is built on a foundation of high-paying jobs in healthcare delivery and medical research, higher education, professional and business services, and finance. Growth in those industries has made Massachusetts one of the most affluent states in the country, but trends are moving in the wrong direction. Zoom in. Payrolls in these core industries are below the high water marks reached in the years after the pandemic. Lawyers, consultants, and other professional business services providers down 25,000 jobs from the peak, or 4%. Information firms, the sector that includes software development, internet services, and data security, down 10,000 jobs, or 10%. Banks, insurance companies, and investment and real estate firms, down 7,500 jobs, or 3.3%. Private education organizations, including colleges and universities, down 1,800 jobs, or 1%. Healthcare, the state's largest sector, has added more than 3,000 jobs this year, extending a long growth streak driven by an aging population requiring more services. Construction, retail, and manufacturing have expanded, while the leisure and hospitality industry has cut jobs every month since 2026. The big picture. The economy is growing solidly. But the state faces a double whammy, a challenging business climate, where an expensive place to run a business, and hostile Trump administration policies toward higher education and life sciences research funding. Tech firms are slashing jobs after a COVID-era hiring binge. Financial services providers have been culling their workforces for years as competition forces them to cut costs. And AI has many employees rethinking their labor needs. After the tech industry, AI is weighing most heavily on financial services, Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, said in an email. Employment is falling due to little hiring and attrition. The blame game. AI has been the most cited reason for U.S. jobs cut this year, accounting for 22% of the total through May, according to Challenger, Gray, and Christmas, an outplacement and executive coaching firm whose monthly layoff report is widely followed by economists. Yet private sector layoffs through April ran at roughly the same rate as the same period in 2025, separate data from the BLS show, and job openings jumped in April to the highest level in almost 2 years. AI isn't yet the job apocalypse, some predicted, said Andy Challenger of Challenger Gray. The open question isn't whether AI changes the workforce, but how fast. To that, I add this question. Will AI boost employment or decimate it? Final thought. I've heard smart people argue both sides as well as scenarios that fall somewhere in the middle. AI could wipe out half of all entry-level white-collar jobs and spike unemployment up to 20% over the next 1 to 5 years. Dario Amonde, CEO of AI model maker Anthropic, said a year ago. Torsten Slark, chief economist at Apollo Global Management, believes AI will spur demand for workers by making them more productive and lowering the cost of services they produce. He offers an AI twist on the Jevons paradox. Economist William Stanley, Jevons' explanation for the increase in coal consumption in mid-19th century Britain, even as steam engines burned coal more efficiently. The jobs numbers we're seeing in Massachusetts don't tell us much about the future, but it's not lost on me that coal is largely a thing of the past. And that is the end of this reading of the Today's Globe from Pete and Liza. And we are at the Talking Information Center. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next week.